This is Roger Molina on Creative Disturbance, and I'm delighted to be speaking again with Dan Sandin. For those of you that listen to the first podcast, we'd like to continue the discussion. So, Dan, maybe you can introduce yourself again.
Hi, I'm Dan Sandin, and I've been working with computers since this early, mid-60s, I guess. And I've been with Tom DeFonte, developed a laboratory called the Electronic Visualization Laboratory, originally called the Circle Graphics Habitat, which has been a collaborative activity of artists and computer scientists and domain scientists that's been in operation since the early 70s.
Okay, very good. So in the first podcast, you talked about a couple of ideas. One was the transition that you lived through between the analog and the digital, but also a little bit of discussion about how the analog is reemerging in many artistic practices today. The second one that you talked about was the way that video technology had this very disruptive effect, not only technically, but also socially. And so, you know, a couple of interesting things that have sort of happened as you've been working over the decades. Now, somehow I want to tie those two topics to one of your current interests. Since you're working on a book project with a number of colleagues on collaboration between artists and scientists, and presumably this is informed by the struggles you've had over the decades. So maybe you can expand.
Okay, so I was brought, as I mentioned in the last podcast, I was brought by the School of Art and Design at the University of Illinois at Chicago in 1969 to bring cybernetic technology, which was the jargon of the times, into the art curriculum. And that was in 1969. In 1973, Tom DeFonte came as a chemistry professor, although he was one of the first computer science graduates. And we worked together with artists and domain scientists and computer scientists to produce various kinds of educational materials and to support the research of the scientists, essentially starting in the early 70s. This laboratory has been in kind of continuous operation with that as its major theme all the way to now. And there's a great deal of power in the collaboration of kind of artists and scientists. And the success of the Electronic Visualization Laboratory is really largely based on that continuous collaboration.
So I mean, obviously, over the years, you've developed methodologies for getting people with those very different backgrounds to work together. I understand that at SIGGRAPH, you've actually presented a course, I think. And so maybe you can just expand a little bit about the kinds of difficulties that can be anticipated and how one might be prepared for them.
Well, so in the process that was going on in the 70s, except for some serious issues having to do with kind of crediting and tenure and things like that, it really wasn't a lot of trouble. Things worked rather smoothly, largely because we're involving students as the primary driver, and the students are there to kind of learn new things and learn some of the technology so they could apply it to their artwork. And the scientists, you know, wanted to be able to produce educational materials for their courses, and also needed kind of graphics presentations and things like that for their papers and conference presentations. There were serious issues we realized after we did this for a while that it maybe wasn't a great service to involve domain scientists in this activity because it was pretty hard for them to get credit for these activities. And that persists to today and is a real constant behavior. And both Tom DeFonte and I had actual troubles making those transitions because of our hybrid activities, and we're essentially saved by upward administrators.
Ironically, In my case, actually, for many, many years, I maintained two different CVs. So depending, you know, what context I was in my own hybrid practice, as you say, it's very difficult for the working sinus engineer to get the kind of credit in their own career promotion and so on. And that problem is obviously a very real one today and probably will not disappear totally. But in terms of, it's interesting that you mentioned that it was easier to work with students than with seasoned professionals. But in terms of the day-to-day working problems, I mean, for some reason, this topic has risen in your consciousness that you're willing to invest time in helping people write a book.
Yeah, I've done a few presentations on kind of art cross science because it interests me. It's been, the kind of power behind, my evolution, both as a computer scientist and as an artist, to be able to combine things from these fields. And there's a few things I learned, and in my interview that I'll be having for this book, I have a fairly short list of what those, what some of the important things are in these collaborations to make sure people get credit essentially in the categories they need credit in. But one of the things is that I still recommend that if, science, that the students are by far the best group to work with in this area. The graduate students and even undergraduate students, partially because they're there to transform themselves through education. And professionals with established careers, that can be a real digression. I mean, a domain physicist really has a very hard time spending a lot of time to learn, let's say, even computer technologies, unless its return is very fast. Because he's busy, trying to essentially advance his career and advance the field. But the students, the graduate students, are really open to this. And so the first rule is kind of like use the professors as kind of contacts and support and work with the students primarily.
Actually, that's an interesting comment you have, which I could maybe inject a slightly different thought into. There's a group that's working on what's called the science of team science that issued a report recently. And one of the things that they pointed out in terms of the problems that scientific teams have working together is indeed the difference in timescales that different people work on. And so obviously for an undergraduate or a master's student, I mean, very typically that their horizon is 1 or 2 years. And say they can get very focused on that time scale, whereas a senior professor or a mid-level researcher is often working on very multi-year initiatives. And so sometimes they're just a mismatch in terms of the expectations in terms of time scales. And that may be another element in how, in working with students, you found it sometimes to go more smoothly. I don't know if that resonates.
Yeah, it's certainly an issue. I don't know if I have anything, particularly helpful to say about that. It's certainly the time scale in my career now takes me much longer to do projects and both artworks than it did when it was a performance and it had a deadline in 3 months and that meant together.
That's quite common that an artist is expecting to produce something on a 3 to 6 month time scale and perform it. Whereas sometimes a scientist is quite happy to do an initial phase, and it's going to be 2 or 3 years before they really expect to get to their conclusion. That's maybe a side issue. What are some of the other things that you've sort of run into and have developed approaches to?
Talking on the more positive side, again, rather than the problems, is there are some things that artists bring to the table that kind of go against the stereotype of artists by and large, which I find the most valuable. And artists are trained in presentation, for instance, and they are trained in producing works that actually have hard deadlines, like shows open on certain dates. Yep. and if the piece is 90% done but has a smudge in the corner, it just doesn't get hung. While in the, let's say, the computer science community or the engineering community, if you get something 90% right where you've got the concepts working and you've learned a lot and maybe even made an important contribution to the field, the fact that the work is incomplete and not done and not presentable is not a showstopper, except maybe at the master thesis and PhD level. But for a lot of the class activities, getting most of it right is what counts.
That's interesting. A few years ago, there was a conference in France and one in England where they tried to discuss the very different that a prototype role that a prototype has from the point of view of an artist and a scientist. And that's sort of an interesting thing of how incrementally different the artist versus the scientist get themselves to where they're trying to go. And as you say, when you're in a deadline-driven environment in the arts, then let me tell you, that prototype has to be fully functional. whereas if you're doing a demo in an engineering lab, then it's kind of a different concept. I would agree with that observation.
Yeah, so one of the things that kind of goes against the stereotypes of artists is I find them to be good project organizers. And because of the way they can, if there is a deadline for a show, let's say, or a presentation at a conference, which is a show, they're kind of experienced with making the compromises and being willing to jettison certain things so that it is presentable. And I think a lot of the success of the electronic visualization laboratory really has to do with the fact that we don't do demos that are partially working. We only do demos that are, you know, that really work and dazzle people and communicate the ideas so that the audience who's seeing it gets the concept and doesn't get distracted by the fact that part of it has to be explained away because it's not working.
I would tend to agree with that. I mean, my problem is I had a lot of project management training when I was doing NASA projects. And so I came out of a project management culture partially. The other thing, though, that I think is, and with all these things, it's dangerous to overgeneralize, but I think in some cases, artists are much more ready to redirect the direction of the project if for some reason something doesn't work out. Whereas often the scientists will have rather well-defined final objectives, and it's kind of hell or high water. That's what we're going to do, is we're going to figure out how to do this. And obviously in the artistic exploration, if you run into obstacles, then you may end up with an artwork that is very different than what you started off conceiving of. And so there's sort of a mobility of the artist sometimes in face of technical difficulties, which is sort of different than the way that the scientist would approach it.
Yeah, I think that's a very good point on it. So you were trained in NASA, which has a very different way of doing it. I keep thinking of the graduate student in computer science going through the kind of course structure.
Well,
in the
case of NASA, I mean, the collaboration team, and there the problem is different. It's you're trying to get scientists, engineers, and managers to work together and companies that are subcontractors.
Yeah.
And clearly that's a group of people that all share the techno-scientific sort of mind view. and so you're in sort of a shared culture. Obviously, in the art science collaborations, we mentioned earlier at the beginning of this discussion that one of the things that artists latched onto in the video revolution was in fact the social aspects of the usability of the technology. Which you know often would not be the thing that the scientists on the project would latch onto, and so that social context of the technology is one that the artist tends to be much more sensitive to.
Yeah. In the case of just thinking about the kind of video revolution of the 70s and the kind of internet revolution and the maker revolution and all of that now is that. I'm always amazed at how much, and of course, part of it just has to do with it's me doing it from my own point of view, how much things stay the same through these revolutions, and they have these kind of cycles of behavior along with kind of, really over-optimistic goals for what the technology can do in terms of the transformation that it can do. But it actually still does quite a bit of the transformation. And then how these activities actually end up then being essentially borged by industry and essentially co-opted into essentially money-making operations, which still preserves some of, because of the way they're designed, preserves some of the affordances or goals of the initial revolution, but are, you know, kind of, you know, now almost being the forces of darkness, which is my view of the communication companies, especially in this country.
Okay, Dad. Well, okay, we're going to have to wrap this up, and it's kind of interesting that over the 15 minutes we've gone between techno optimism to techno pessimism. So, which is
Pessimistic. I just think the next revolution has to happen. I don't know quite what it's going to be, but for all of this, and then there'll be a new group of utopians trying to push it in a new direction. But not until it's a new revolution.
Okay, very good, Dad. Okay, good talking to you, and thank you so much for your time.